Welcome back, campers.
That was your host, Genevieve.
That was your host, Caitlin.
And you have arrived at this week's installment of Camping is Canceled. Surprise if maybe you clicked on the wrong podcast and that's not what you were expecting to hear.
Whoops. This is... I don't even know what other podcast comes to mind, even though I listen to like a bazillion all the time.
Oh, gosh. This isn't D&D table play.
No. Nope. This is the one you should be listening to.
Mm-hmm. And this is part two of our two-parter on the Diet Law of Pass incident. So if you're just tuning in, do yourself a favor and listen to part one first. Obviously. We've been through this.
Yes, you
we
know the
drill. We
do
a lot
drill.
Of 2-3-parters.
Yes.
You guys know 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. You know the order. And we're going to jump right back in where we left off, which was March of 1959. 9 young hikers never made it home from a carefully planned out backpacking trip deep in the heart of Russia's Ural Mountains under increasingly odd circumstances. Searchers had located 4 of their bodies several hundred yards away from the abandoned tent, without shoes or coats. But 5 hikers were still missing, and every day that passed made the search feel bleaker. Once more into the heart of the frozen mountains and Soviet Russian conspiracies we go. Lights out, campers.
Oh man, the mountains call my number 1. I'm just a life-size lottery ticket in the hand of the one.
Newly appointed lead prosecutor Lev Ivanov finally arrived on the scene and got to work on his report. Ivanov was able to determine that the remains of the fire that had been built by Doroshenko and Krivoshenko looked to have burned for around 2 hours before it died. It also appeared that Doroshenko had climbed the small tree above it in order to break off branches for the fire, but likely due to his body shutting down from hypothermia, he appeared to have slipped and fallen and just not gotten back up. This would explain the broken branches that were found lying underneath him. Both young men appeared to have passed away trying to get warm and even had their arms reaching into the fire. Oddly, though, Ivanov did note that there was a pile of small branches next to the fire that hadn't yet been burned. That says to me that maybe they were trying to just keep the fire going longer and not make it bigger necessarily.
That makes sense.
I don't know. That is still a little weird. He also closely examined the tent and found it to be structurally sound with its poles firmly rooted into the ground on the slope. And Caitlin, I actually did get sort of an answer to the question you posed. I don't know if you did it in the first episode or if it's something that we get to later when you and I were talking about it, but you said, why didn't they just set up camp in the woods? Because they were actually close to some woods.
Yes.
And I was able to learn from the book that I was reading that the area that they pitched their tent actually was the one that had the least amount of snow coverage on the ground. So they had to get those tent poles to go deep into the ground.
Oh, okay.
And even in the woods, there was a lot of snow and they would have been having to get the tent poles down through all of that to get into the ground. So
that makes sense. Yeah. And again, like, it's an easy answer.
Yeah, but one worth talking about when you're like, well, why wouldn't they just
set
up in the woods?
Without that easy answer, then my brain's going down so many different paths.
Absolutely. A securely built storage shelter was found near the Aspia River, called a labaz, that the hikers had put together the day before their final night, which held all the necessary supplies for their return trip, like food, extra skis and boots, a first aid kit, and Georgie's mandolin. This indicated to searchers that the group had been going strong 10 days into their hike. They clearly had plenty of supplies to spare, and they were still closely following trail protocols. The presence of Georgie's mandolin also indicated how committed the hikers were to completing their mission, since they were willing to part with the extra weight of something they all loved to make their time on the trail as efficient as possible. Once the bodies of Doroshenko, Krivoshenko, Igor, and Zina were flown back to Yivdel, the process of autopsies could finally begin and hopefully provide some answers. By now, it had been over a month since the group went missing, and searchers had long lost any hope of finding the remaining five hikers alive. They were also covering even less ground a day due to many of the original searchers having to get back to school and work, and they were now fully relying on dogs and avalanche poles to search for what was lying beneath the snow.
Finally, on March 5th, 1959, an area about 1,000 yards from the tent, the fifth hiker was found. It was Rastik Slobodin, who was affectionately known as the group's rich kid. Rastik was found dead beneath several inches of snow and was laying face down, with his right leg bent beneath him and his right fist pulled close to his chest. He was dressed in a checkered shirt, sweater, ski trousers, several pairs of socks, and a single felt shoe. His ski cap was also pulled firmly down over his head. The position of his body was approximately halfway between the bodies of Igor and Zina, and he was oriented toward the tent as if he had been working his way up the slope at the time of his collapse. There was a small hollow of encrusted snow around his mouth where his breath had melted it, which suggested he had actually been alive for some time after he fell. Weirdest of all, though, was that the front of his head was deeply discolored, as if he had sustained a blunt force injury. The next discovery wasn't a body, but it was extremely important to the mystery. The three slashes along the backside of the tent, one of which was large enough for an adult to climb through, were determined under careful microscopic analysis by scientific officer and criminal expert G. Cherkina to be from inside the tent, not from the outside as was originally thought. So this changed things quite a bit. It meant the hikers were the ones fleeing their own tent. By now, the causes of death for all five hikers who had been found was ruled to be hypothermia, which was not surprising to anyone. But what they still had no idea of what was where the circumstances that put them all in that position. During this time, Yuri Yudin was flown via helicopter to Yivdel, where he was greeted with a giant mound of all his friends' belongings. God, that's dark.
Yeah, because he was the only one that had been with them most recently to been able to, like, identify them.
Mm-mm. And he was given the heartbreaking task of dividing them all into 9 separate piles, down to the teddy bear that Georgie still slept with. There's something about the name Georgie that, and maybe it's because it's my childhood cat, maybe because it just reminds me of, like, a little boy, like, the, oh.
I love that name, and also that's heartbreaking. Oh.
He then had to share the return helicopter ride with sealed buckets that contained his friend's internal organs that were being taken for further testing.
God.
And that is fucked.
Yeah. Oh, poor Yuri.
Gosh.
And if we didn't specify it before, it's important that we note that Rastik was believed to have sustained a blunt force injury at first because the skin on his forehead was so dark, but that was not what actually happened.
Is that like post when the blood settles?
I believe so. Okay. Just the liver mortis.
Yeah. Liver. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
That feels like it's...
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when they saw him, they were like, oh, that doesn't look right. He must have got hit in the head. But it was, in fact, just that. As if the pain of losing their children wasn't enough, for whatever reason, regional authorities began giving the families of the five hikers who had been found major pushback in having their bodies returned to Sverdlovsk. Party officials summoned family members one by one into private meetings and strongly pressed them that it would be best for all of the hikers to be buried in a single grave hundreds of miles away in Yivdel, with only a small commemorative plaque and no funeral ceremony. When each household sat down with officials, they were informed that Everyone else had already agreed to have their family members buried in Yveddale and to not have a funeral. This was, obviously, not true, and Zena's parents actually requested that all the families be brought into one meeting together. But the secretary of the Institute Committee of the Regional Communist Party made a bunch of excuses that, oh, the families were just too spread out to hold a single meeting. The families were understandably furious at this being bullshitted around and the disgraceful handling of this situation. So they stood their ground and demanded together that their hikers be returned to them and that they be allowed to hold a funeral in the city. And finally, the authorities sort of relented under the bizarre condition that the hiker's funeral could not be one large event. They had to split it into two services held over two separate days. They also refused to allow the funeral procession to pass by the UPI campus and said that the coffins had to go directly from the morgue to the cemetery via the shortest and least visible route possible. The families and Yuri knew that this was a deliberate attempt to minimize the funeral turnout, like by splitting it into 2 days,
yeah,
because they knew that a lot of people couldn't be like, well, I can't stay for 2 days. Like, I can only do one. It's so weird. Yeah. And they also were trying to minimize potential exposure to the press and maybe people who weren't aware of the hikers' deaths by having the procession be as inconspicuous as possible. But fortunately, all of this fuckery didn't stop over 1,000 people from joining the funeral procession for the 5 hikers. During the ceremony, multiple people noticed men standing around dressed in civilian clothing, but the whole time they were intently staring at the people in the crowd and not watching the service itself. The families firmly believed that those people were KGB officers, but for what reason, they couldn't possibly begin to fathom. Yuri Yudin himself was so heartbroken over the loss of his friends that he didn't go to the funeral because he couldn't bear to see them lowered into the ground. I would have been the exact same way. And you guys, you can find a picture that, don't look this up unless you want to feel gutted, but it is a picture of the coffins laying and they're getting ready to be buried. Like they're laying right next to the burial plot and they're open so that you can see their faces. And there's, I don't know, someone's mom or grandma, but with the, like the scarf wrapped around her head. And she's just like bent over touching the face. I already cried about it, but yeah, just...
Oh, God.
It's so easy for us to get caught up in the conspiracy of all of this and the fact that it was so long ago. I mean, it really wasn't that long ago when you really think about it. But it's just such a unspeakable tragedy.
Ugh, man, my heart hurts so bad.
Yeah.
And I mean, side note, I've been to, I can't even count how many funerals I've been to.
Ugh.
From working at the nursing home.
Oh.
And I mean, my own family, I have never been able to watch somebody be lowered into the ground.
Oh, no.
I'm like, yeah. So I feel you, Yuri.
That takes a special kind of strength.
Ugh.
And it takes strength to be able to be like, no, I am not going to do that. And I'm going to only remember them as they were in life. Because funerals are really for the people who are living. They're not for the people who have passed. So total respect if Yuri was like, no, not doing that.
Oh my gosh. On May 3rd, nearly 4 full months after the hikers first went missing, the discovery of an unusual clump of branches that appeared to have been cut with a knife led searchers to find a small pile of clothing nearby. There was no sign of a body around it. It was just a crumpled gray vest turned inside out and a pair of knitted trousers. A brown woolen sweater with lilac thread, a right trouser leg, and 1-yard-long bandage. Some of the clothing also appeared to be weirdly cut and shredded. Nearby, there was another pair of black cotton sports trousers and half of a woman's sweater that was later confirmed to belong to Lydia Dubinina. For 2 days, searchers focused on the area around where the clothing was found, which led them closer and closer to the slushy floor of a rocky creek bed that was flanked on one side by a 24-foot-high ravine at a steep 60-degree angle. After hours of digging with shovels and probing with avalanche rods, finally, nearly all at the same time, the bodies of the final four hikers emerged, lying in a soup of melting snow and creek water. Decomposition was already so advanced that Lydia was the only one recognizable right away. It would be confirmed during autopsies that the other three bodies indeed belonged to Sasha, Alexander, and Kolya. One of the young men's bodies was found lying alone, wearing a gray sweater and two wristwatches. The other two men were found embracing one another, as if they'd been trying to keep warm. All three of their bodies were orientated towards the center of the stream. Lydia was dressed in a cap, a yellow undershirt, two sweaters, brown ski trousers, and two socks on one foot. The other foot was wrapped in a torn sweater. She was oriented with her head pointed upstream.
The first autopsy performed on 24-year-old Alexander revealed that, like the others, he didn't have on boots, but he was wearing several layers of clothing, and in his pockets was a box of matches and an empty bottle of pain medicine. His ankle was bandaged, but that appeared to be from an old injury that was already mostly healed. His cause of death, like the previous five hikers, was determined to be hypothermia. And it was expected that the remaining three hikers would be more or less the same, but not quite. The autopsy of 37-year-old Sasha, remember he was the one that rolled up at the last minute and they got to know him literally on the trip, revealed that the right side of his chest had sustained a brutal injury, serious enough that five of his ribs were fractured, and he had suffered massive internal bleeding. The autopsy report concluded that the injury had been caused by a, quote, large force while Sasha was still alive. He was also dressed in several layers of clothing with no boots. 23-year-old Kolya's autopsy revealed that he had sustained a traumatic injury to his skull, and his cause of death was from an, quote, impressed fracture of the skull dome and base with abundant hemorrhage. This also was ruled to have occurred while Kolya was still alive by, quote, effect of a large force. But by far, it was Lyuda whose body appeared to have suffered the most severe injuries. 9 of her ribs were fractured, and she had suffered immense internal hemorrhaging, including in her right heart ventricle. And with no further explanation, the autopsy report stated that Lyuda's tongue was missing. Sasha, Kolya, and Lyuda's deaths were classified as simply, quote, violent. And as horrible as these injuries were, and it's easy to get lost in all sorts of wild theories of what might have caused them, and that's something people still like to go on about to this day. But the reality is that if the hikers encountered that 24-foot drop right at the edge of the ravine, in the pitch black dark, the one they were found very close to, the fall that they would have made onto the sharp, heavy rocks, barely covered with snow at the bottom, would easily account for that large force that caused their terrible injuries. The only one who hadn't suffered broken bones, Alexander, had most likely fallen on top of one of his friends. So, yeah. And the one other thing that I will mention is that Lyuda's missing tongue, and would not recommend looking up pictures, but there are pictures that you can find of the young men who were found in the creek and their eyes are missing. This was not because of alien laser beams or torture or what conspiracy theories are going to have you to believe, but we believe, and people way smarter than us do, that it is very, very likely that this was just because when you are going through decomposition, especially if you are sitting in standing water, the soft tissues of your body are going to be the very first things to go. And if there's water, there's microorganisms in that water that are going to speed up that process that much faster. Mm-hmm. So it is completely within the realm of reason that their eyes and Leuta's tongue would have just been gone by that point. So we can pretty easily attribute that to that, but doesn't mean it's any less horrible to see. So yeah.
Tensions were already high between local officials and the families of the hikers, and they only became more so when they got involved in the funeral plans again for the last four victims. This time, only immediate family was allowed to be present for a closed casket ceremony at a military hospital.
Well, okay.
Go fuck yourselves.
Yeah.
I would have died so fast in Soviet Russia.
Your sass would have gotten you two in the back of the head, and you would have been like, take me home, Jesus. Fuck all of you.
Only Ludia's father had been permitted to see his daughter's body, but the moment her coffin lid was slid back, he fainted on the spot. After this, none of the other families were permitted to see their loved ones. Lev Ivanov believed it must have been something, quote, unusual and unprecedented, that bore only a threat of death, that drove the hikers from their tent into the pitch black and sub-zero temperatures in such a panic that they cut the back of the tent open and abandoned their shoes and coats. Speculation swirled about bizarre lights in the sky and weapons testing, but nothing had any sort of solid evidence. The closest Ivanov came to a lead was when he ordered a radiation test to be performed on the clothing of the four hikers found in the creek bed. And what you need to know about the results of that test is this. They came back as showing that within the hikers' bodies, there was not radiation beyond the normal and naturally occurring potassium-40 isotope. But their clothing was another matter. All of it indicated the presence of radiation levels as being twice the, quote, natural occurring level. This led Ivanov to speculate that their clothing must have been contaminated by either radioactive dust in the atmosphere or some other substance. But, in the wake of this discovery, Ivanov was ordered by his superiors to close the Dyatlov case effective immediately. Even though he or anyone else had officially cited a particular cause for what drove the hikers to suffer deaths by hypothermia and other injuries, all he had been able to determine, which he wrote in the official case file, was that the cause of the hikers' deaths was due to, quote, an unknown compelling force. The families of the hikers were told absolutely nothing, and the Northern Ural Mountains were officially closed by authorities for 3 years.
I feel like that's got to be just a formality, because it was so out in the middle of absolute fucking nowhere. How are they going to keep people from going out
honestly,
there? Honestly, though.
Like Yellowstone where there's like...
Yeah.
Patrol. I don't know. I don't know what the Ural Mountains are like.
Yeah. And we will never know, because we're never going there. Now, before we dive into the theories on what happened here, and there's a lot... We think it's important that we leave off this part of the story by remembering the 9 Dyatlov hikers for who they were in life on the last few days they spent together. And we have a pretty good idea how that went, thanks to their diary entries and photographs. Many pictures showed them smiling and laughing with their arms around each other, and in one photograph, Rustik was beaming and wearing a very singed jacket. It didn't seem to be bothering him too much. The jacket is literally like black and like hanging in ribbons, and he's just like,
oh, yeah, yeah,
I'm happy to be here.
He's living life.
Yes. They also celebrated Doroshenko's 21st birthday and delighted him with the surprise of a tangerine, which he insisted on sharing with everyone. They wrote up their own newspaper about the events of the day that they called the Evening O'Torton, and as he observed his friends huddled together in their warm tent, sharing toast and hot chocolate, Igor Dyatlov jotted down what would be the group's final diary entry. Quote, "It's hard to imagine such a cozy place anywhere at the ridge under the piercing howls of the wind and hundreds of kilometers from any settlements." The next morning, the group constructed a small shelter to store supplies for the return trip and grimly battled increasingly harsh weather the closer they came to the base of the mountain. The only pictures of the hikers from that day showed them in a tight single-file line, with their heads and shoulders hunched in determination, pushing forward into the gray nothingness. They were tantalizingly close to Mount Otorten and the achievement of being outdoorsmen and women of the highest level. They stopped around 4 p.m. to set up camp for the night and quickly worked together in the bitter cold and increasingly harsh wind to assemble their tent. They were grateful that instead of struggling to keep warm, they knew that the tent's thick layers of canvas and their powerful little camp stove would quickly make the tent get so warm they would have to take turns sleeping next to it because it would actually get too warm. At around 9 p.m., everyone had crawled into the tent and settled in for the night, but tragically, within just a few hours, that unknown compelling force that would make the Dyatlov Pass one of the world's most infamous unsolved modern mysteries would claim their lives. Nowadays, if you make the rugged journey to the base of Otorten Mountain, there is a bronze plaque commemorating the courage of the 9 young friends who perished there. And tucked into the crevice of a large boot-shaped boulder, you might find dozens of crumbling handwritten letters and copies of the many joyful black-and-white photographs that the friends took on their journey. The plaque reads, "In the memory of those who have gone and will never return, we have named this mountain pass in their honor, the Dyatlov Pass."
Never before have I cried about people that I didn't know before doing this podcast.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have.
I guess that's true. I cry all the time. Oh, gosh. But, oh my god.
Gosh dang it.
This one.
How come every time we're like, hey guys, we're gonna do a more lighthearted one this week. It's not so bad. And then we're like sniffing. Oh my gosh.
That's because they were babies.
They're somebody's baby. That's what I tell Jake. Yeah. Like, Jen and I have this pact that we're not going to do kid stuff. But now, every time I sneak some, I'm like, that's somebody's baby. That's somebody's baby.
I know.
Okay. One more thingy. Now, if your head isn't spinning with questions yet, don't worry. It's about to get much worse. Because now what we have to get into are the theories. And just to be clear, we at Camping Is Cancelled do not question that the actual cause of what stopped the hikers' hearts was either hypothermia or injuries they sustained from falling into the creek bed. What these theories are going to explore is what no one has been able to agree on for over 50 years. Who or what made them abandon all reason and flee the safety of their tent, barefoot, into the endless pitch-black darkness and sub-zero temperatures? Big question mark.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, theory number one. The hikers were attacked by a group of Mansi or Kanti, or even one single local. People threw this out mostly at the beginning of the investigation, but this as a plausible theory quickly falls apart for several reasons. The first being, the nearest village of people was around 60 whole miles away, so not exactly close enough for people to pop by and commit a murder. There was also no hunting to be had on that mountain. It was so devoid of animal and plant life that the Mansi actually referred to it as Halachal, which means the dead mountain.
I know. It sounds super ominous and creepy, but it just means dead as in no vegetation, but it is still a little spooky.
It also had no spiritual or other significance to the Mansi or Kanti, so they would have had no reason to be out there other than to carry out a planned attack on these college students. There was also no physical evidence of attacks or sexual assaults on their bodies or signs of defensive wounds, and no signs of a violent struggle in or around the tent. Remember, everything in the tent was found perfectly in order. Finally, not only would murderous attack have been wildly out of character for the groups, who were and are a very peaceful people. Remember, they literally invited the hikers to stay with them and then joined them in search efforts to find them. It just wouldn't have made sense logically because they would have had to do this in the pitch black, dark, in negative 25 degrees and 40 mile per hour winds for no reason. So we can move on from that one pretty quickly.
Yeah. There's also no mention in their diary entries that they were seeing Mansi.
Right.
When they were out on the previous days of their hike, they did see some ski tracks and they would see older symbols that had been painted or carved into the trees, but it wasn't like they were randomly seeing people scurrying through the trees being sinister again.
Oh, that creeps me out.
I know, but you know what I'm saying though? Like, yeah. There's never any indication that they're like, we think we're being followed or we're seeing people.
And they were pretty, I know they're on a mountain, there are forests and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
but there were vast openness at the same time. So
absolutely. You're not really going to be able to hide and sneakily follow someone. The second theory is that the hikers had been suddenly swept away by very high winds. This was another early theory because high winds were something that the hikers had been warned about by a local forester named Ivan Rempel right before they started the hike. High winds were a known danger on the pass in the local area, and if you found yourself swept off your feet, I mean, just imagine you're at the top of a hill or next to a ravine or even being blown so far that you kind of become disoriented and lose your path and you're in sub-zero temperatures, the result could easily be fatal. It was suggested that maybe one or two of the hikers, most likely the ones who were found wearing boot liners, had quickly stepped outside of the tent to pee when a sudden gust of wind had just swept them off their feet. They would have cried out, and maybe the rest of the hikers had run out to try and save them in such a hurry that they'd cut one side of the tent open, didn't even bother to put on shoes, they just ran out. Even as I'm reading that, it just kind of like seems to be like less and less likely.
More like sitcom, like
yeah.
A funny scenario.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's...
It doesn't hold up for me. Mainly just from what we know of how meticulous these guys were with following safety protocols. They would have known how useless they would be for going and saving their friends. So say even two of them did get swept away, they wouldn't have run out without putting on shoes and coats because it would have slowed them down so much mm-hmm. that they would have been useless. So
I mean, one had a camera still around his neck, so
yeah.
Why a camera, not shoes or a coat?
Right, exactly. This would also mean the winds would have had to have been strong enough to blow all nine hikers hundreds of yards down the face of the mountain, but at the same time, not be strong enough to blow away the tent. Or even, remember, Rustic was found with his own knit hat firmly pulled down onto his head. So surely that mm-hmm. would have gotten snatched off. Weather analysis done of that night also indicated that the winds had gotten up to 40 miles per hour, which is strong, but not strong enough to reach what is considered destructive on the Beaufort wind scale, and nowhere close to hurricane force winds, which start at 74 miles per hour and go up from there. And these guys were hiking into a 40 mile per hour headwind earlier that
right.
day. So if that wasn't blowing them over, then I don't think it happened when one of them went out to pee. That one, I know why we have to talk about it, because it was a danger that was mentioned to mm-hmm. them. And so I bet local people were like, ooh, like maybe they got caught in those high winds. But because of the time that it happened, it just doesn't make sense. Next.
Theory number three. The hikers met foul play at the hands of rogue Soviet military or escaped prisoners.
This theory was considered most strongly in the early stages of the investigation to explain those three large slashes at the back of the tent and why they all left in a hurry without shoes. Like, maybe they had been ordered out into the snow by men with guns. But again, for the same reasons the Mansi theory doesn't hold up, neither does this one. No more than the 9 sets of footprints belonging to the hikers when they left the tent were ever found at the scene, or prints leading away from the bodies. There were 0 reports of escaped prisoners from the nearest prison camp, which was over 50 miles away, and if you remember, when those slashes were closely examined in the lab, they were found to have been made from the inside out.
Mm. So not like someone attacked and was trying to get in. Yeah.
The different locations of the hikers' bodies also poke holes in this theory because they were so spread apart, and then you have the ones that were down in the ravine. Even if they had been killed in one spot and spread out by multiple people, there would have been far more tracks. But also, why?
Yeah.
This would have been so difficult to do in the dark that their attackers could have easily gotten lost and died themselves. Like,
honestly, though, like, what makes you think that someone else would have fared better in those conditions, even if they had...
Like, snowmobiles or, like, a vehicle of some sort. Again, you would see that track, though.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You will see people on the internet regularly bringing up that when Yuri Yudin had to go separate his friends' belongings into their respective piles, he had noticed that some of their items seemed to be missing. And you could say that gives legs to foul play speculation until you dig further into the actual case file, like the author of Dead Mountain did, and see that these, quote, missing items were just a few bars of chocolate and a bottle of medicinal alcohol, and Xena's stuffed hedgehog that was a lucky charm she always kept with her.
Aww.
Yeah.
Then, after a little while, it was discovered that the hedgehog wasn't missing. It had just already been mistakenly placed with Rustic's things.
He probably stole it, like, several days ago.
And like, as a joke or something.
Was like, where? Or he just liked it and was like, this is my lucky charm now. So he's like, where is my hedgehog? Rustic's just snuggling it at night. Mm? Oh, God.
And in a later interview with Boris and Mikhail, the two classmates who had first found the tent, they actually admitted that they taken and drunk the bottle of alcohol.
Those did we not? Cold, hard Russians.
I know.
It was medicinal alcohol.
Did we not say in part while we were like, we bet those fuckers drank that?
Mazel tov. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not being used.
I certainly would if I was out there.
I'd have to have something to warm me.
Mm-hmm.
So, it wouldn't be wild to assume that the chocolate bars had met a similar fate at the hands of other searchers. And if those were the only things missing, you see where we're going with this.
Yeah. So, next. Pretty much.
Or at least that theory with the military isn't, like, I don't like the line of thought of with it. Like, it being easily like, oh, they were just lined up and...
Yeah.
But why separated from their tent to die?
In weirdly different places with, again, no sign of gunshot wounds or poisoning or, you know, strangling. It just doesn't make sense.
Next.
So now theory number 4. The members of the group were inebriated either from alcohol, drugs, or from carbon monoxide poisoning. Drugs and alcohol are really a hard no because toxicology reports show that there was no foreign substances in the hiker systems. And carbon monoxide was not possible because, and here is something that I just learned actually today, I was under the impression that they had a gas camp stove. Apparently they did not, and they had a wood burning stove. Oh. So that alone eliminates the carbon monoxide theory because you wouldn't get that from a wood burning stove. Now maybe you could get like smoke inhalation, you know, like, but it's different than carbon monoxide poisoning. So that wasn't even really an option. And remember, Boris and Mikhail found the pieces of the stove laid out, like they were getting ready to put it together, but mm-hmm. they had not yet. So they wouldn't have had a reason to be like, oh shit, something's burning, this, you know, right. everything's filling up with smoke, we got to get out. And even if that did happen, why wouldn't they have just like cleared out really fast, aired it out, and then got right back in? Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have just made their way down the mountain. Now, people will also bring up the stove because you'll see in forums and stuff that the tent was found burned. And that's also become part of the lore for like alien or supernatural theories. But this is really stupid. And what we actually know from the hikers' diaries and photographs is that one of the group, I believe it was Rustic, had laid his wet coat next to the stove to dry it out, but it got a little crispy and his jacket got really badly scorched. And this is super apparent in some of the photos of him taken the last day that they were alive. His coat is like singed and shredded, but he looks like he's having a grand old time. He does not look bothered by it at all. So that could have caused some very slight like burns or scorch marks on the inside of the tent. But if these were there, they were so minimal that they were not even noted initially by the searchers or in the first report that was made by the criminal prosecutor. So it's not a plausible theory that that caused them to like flee out into the snow. So yeah. And it wasn't a beam of alien fire shooting down from the sky. Next.
Theory number 5. It was a lover's quarrel. Obviously, if there's a mystery involving a group of young people who were, quote, the best of friends, and they all meet a tragic end and are of the opposite sex, it must have had something to do with sex and obsession, right? If this was a season of Riverdale, yes.
Most definitely.
Yes. Oh my goodness. People will bring up this theory because in the group's diary entries, when they talk about all the things they did and talked about during the day, they mention that the girls like to talk about romance and relationships and ask the boys their thought on love. That's just normal.
It really is. They're young.
They're literally in a tent smushed together in the middle of BFE.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Without drugs. Without alcohol. What
else are you going to talk about but pheromones?
Yeah.
That's totally normal. Ugh.
And then, later on, among Igor's belongings, a small black and white photograph of a smiling and fully clothed Xena was found tucked in one of his books.
No. When I read that honestly, like, pierced my heart because I was just like, If it's the classic, if he wanted to, he would. Men
but
do
maybe
not
he
do
was,
anything.
But maybe he didn't have time.
I know. What I'm saying is men do not do anything without intention. So if he had a picture of her stuck in there, it's because he liked her.
That's true.
He wouldn't just be like, I just need a bookmark.
Can I get your headshot, please? Oh, my goodness.
Oh.
And that picture was the extent of it. According to Yuri Yudin himself, no one in the group was dating or hooking up with one another. In fact, as far as he knew, none of them had even had sex yet. Yuri, what if you were just kind of out of the loop?
I know, I was just thinking that. I was like, you know, he could say that, but just because they weren't openly talking about it doesn't mean that they weren't, you know.
Or even if they didn't have sex, that doesn't mean they can't flirt, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Anywho, we're trying to debunk this theory.
Yeah, we are. We are pretty confident at this point that they weren't having full-blown orgies in the tent after a full day on the trail.
At least not for photographing it.
Yeah.
I mean, give it the old college try.
Oh, God.
Yuri said it was certainly possible that a couple of the guys had crushes on Xena. She was very beautiful and kind and magnetic. But any group discussions about love and romance were very innocent and more about the romance of life and art than sex. He also said that in 1959, it was considered very anti-Soviet to express feelings for just one person, and so it just wasn't a thing they considered. And also, overall, the group just genuinely got along well and treated their mission to get their level 3 sportsman certifications very seriously. They had minor squabbles and disagreements, just like any other close group of friends, and were very open about those in their diary entries. Things like the boys arguing about the quickest way to put the camp stove together. They were young adults. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And they're in very close quarters and only around each other for days on end.
But there is no indication in any of their photographs or diaries of an escalating tension that would possibly lead to what exactly?
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Even if there had been a quarrel over love or sex, there's not a single one of them who was so hot-tempered they would have stomped away from the safety of the tent without shoes.
Yeah.
I've been pissed. Okay? And I've done, like, stupid things in the haste of, like, leaving when pissed. But
yeah.
I don't think that you would abandon all sense of safety and, yeah. like... I don't think you get pitched and stomp away into the
yeah.
pitch darkness and negative 40 degree weather.
In different directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here's the thing, too, is that let's just say, for shits and giggles sake, that there was some undercurrents of sexual tension. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that Igor and Xena, because I want them to have, you know, a storyline and mm-hmm. all of this, that they maybe were having an intimate moment and got caught
mm-hmm.
and there was like an argument that ensued. Even then, you cannot make me believe that it escalated to the point where they were all knowingly putting themselves in a fatal situation,
mm-hmm.
leaving again without shoes separately. Igor and Xena weren't even near each other when their bodies were found. Mm-hmm. And so there's just nothing that points to it in any way.
Yeah, I get, again, like, all the theories we're going to present,
mm-hmm.
there's a reason why they're presented.
Yeah.
But this one's just a no.
Yeah.
Just move on. Mm-hmm. Next.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Theory number 6. The group had inadvertently stumbled into a nuclear or chemical weapons testing zone, and this weapon was what killed them, and by killed them, we mean drove them from the tent out into the wilderness. This theory did not arise until after their autopsies had been conducted, and the hikers' clothing was put through various testing. In one test, 2 sets of the hikers' clothing were reported to have tested 2 to 3 times higher than what was considered normal at the time for levels of radiation in 1959.
1959 Soviet Russia.
Right.
So the normal is pretty low.
Yeah. There's a low threshold there. So what if, it was theorized, some kind of military weapon, possibly nuclear, had exploded in the sky above or near the campsite and forced them to flee from the tent? Maybe radiation or chemical burns could have explained some of the odd things about how their bodies were found, like their abnormally dark, almost dark orange colored skin. Now, if we've learned anything from Stranger Things, we know how the Russian government likes to be top secret about things they're doing in their underground labs and stuff. So it seems like, oh, there could be something there. But in 2012, these radiation on the clothing results were examined again at the University of Chicago Medical Research Center, and it was determined that by today's understanding of radiation, which I would argue is better than it was in 1959, the level of beta particle decays found on the hikers' clothing and cited in the Dyatlov case file were actually nowhere near a dangerous range. And for them to have posed like a life-threatening threat to the hikers, they would have had to have been anywhere from 50 to 100 times higher, so staggeringly higher. In 1959, the closest documented nuclear testing in the country that same winter had been a full 850 miles away on the islands of Zavaya Zemlya. So we know that was documented. That doesn't mean that it wasn't happening undocumented, but just giving you what we know. And it is feasible that trace amounts of radiation from that testing had made its way to the Northern Urals through the atmosphere and water cycle, which would explain why it showed up in some of their clothing, but not all and not very much of it. So yeah, environmental atmospheric radiation is very much a thing.
Yes.
But it is also weird. It's still weird. Because why wasn't it on the rest of their clothes? But again, remember, even the small amount of radiation that did show up, it was only on two of their clothes, and none was found anywhere else. As far as their darkly discolored skin, according to the director of Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center's Advanced Response Team, who is highly experienced in wilderness medicine and the effects of hypothermia, he explained that it was far more plausible that the discoloration was due to the hikers' bodies lying exposed for days in a high altitude with zero humidity and strong UV rays that would have penetrated through cloud coverage and through snow coverage, because you can still get sunburned, like, at the beach underwater, terribly. And this would have quickly caused, like, a mummifying effect, and it would have made their skin quickly look almost like, I'm so sorry, but like jerky?
I mean, but that is what it's,
yeah.
They're dehydrating.
Yes. Like, yes. And they probably were already more tanned and sunburned to begin with because they had been out there for 10 days at that point. And have you ever seen photographs of like snowy mountain hikers or skiers when they take those goggles off? Yeah. And holy shit, the burns.
From that like wind
burn. Yes.
Like, I mean, hell, the snow's just reflecting all the rays right back to you too.
Yeah. Yeah. But wait, there's more. This is theory number 7, but it kind of goes along with the other one, so we're going to kind of lump them all together. It goes into the more like weapon, rocket, weird military stuff, so this might get a little convoluted, so bear with me. In February of 1959, prior to the hikers going missing, it later comes out that there were local people in the area who had seen lights in the sky. They had seen what they described as these brilliant, bright white lights that actually drew them out of their homes. And they were like, what the actual fuck is that? But they were not starting to come out with these reports and put two and two together until you have this handful of hikers turning up dead and they're trying to look for answers. So Lev Ivanov, the man who was assigned lead prosecutor in this, or lead investigator, whatever, mm-hmm. in this case, he was never able to say what he genuinely thought publicly while he was investigating the case. But he himself firmly believed that these orb sightings were somehow connected to the hiker's death. And in 1990, so this is well after his retirement, mm-hmm. he did an interview where he said, quote, I can't tell for sure whether those orbs were weapons or not, but I'm certain that they were directly related to the death of the hikers. Then, later that same year, he wrote a super long letter to a newspaper where he connected these orbs to the violent injuries that were found on the hikers that were in the bottom of the ravine. So this is, to me, where he gets a little bit less credible, because he says that those orbs were, quote, someone wanted to intimidate people or show off power, and so they did so by killing three hikers. I know all details of this event and can say that only those who were inside the orbs know more than me. Whether there were people inside that time or any time is yet unclear.
Okay, we went on different paths of thinking.
Yeah, so Lev wouldn't ever say whether or not he thought these orbs were some kind of Russian military weapon. Uh-huh. He would only say that they were vaguely, quote, energy bundles unexplained by modern science. So it's not completely out of the question, uh-huh. because there were classified rocket launches happening during this time, but also there had been tests like that happening in February and March of that year. Mm-hmm. The thing is that it is firmly believed by historians and experts that none of these would have affected the hikers on that particular night of February 1st and 2nd. Mm-hmm. And on those exact nights, there is no evidence, no mention of people seeing light orbs in the sky. It was prior and after, okay, but not during. So it's one of those things where, was it?
See,
was it not?
That immediately is like a red herring to me, where mm-hmm. he is being puppeteered by the government to say these outlandish things. I know that I am a conspiracy nut. I love them.
Yeah.
And so, like, I immediately go to, this man is, again, being puppeteered to say certain things to mm-hmm. skew the public's yeah. viewpoint. And
yes. Ooh. Yes. And I forgot to mention this earlier, but these orb sightings, which actually were documented as occurring on February 17th and March 31st, were described by numerous witnesses and actually happened within minutes of documented, corroborated rocket testing happening from the Baikonur testing site, which was also the Soviet missile and space station. Mm-hmm. So any other rocket tests that happened in the Soviet Union during that time period came from a place called Heise Island, which was over 1,200 miles away.
Yeah.
And these rockets had a maximum flight range of no more than 100 miles. So that pretty much eliminates any chance that they would have seen something.
Well, and again, that eliminates the documented things, mm-hmm. but regardless, yes. even if it was undocumented, we don't have the testimonies from people surrounding that area.
You're right. Now, there was a photo uh-huh. that was taken on Georgie's camera. It was actually the final photo mm-hmm. that he took. And that photo has really been the thing that's kind of kept these like weapons testing, yeah. UFO speculation alive. And you can find this photo super easily. We'll post it along with the episode. But it's black background. And then there's these like almost like a flare or like a dot, 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 dot of like orbs, like blurry orbs. And the source of light is, you can't tell where it's coming mm-hmm. from. It's not focused. It almost looks like a smear of light.
Yeah, it looks almost like taking a picture through a windshield or like yes. window.
Yes.
And you're getting like a reflection back almost. Mm-hmm.
And there's like a octagonal uh-huh. like shape in the center. And most experts who look at it think that that is pretty easily caused by, so when the eight blades of a camera's aperture do the like shuttering thing and you aren't focused on anything or it was like oh. accidentally pressed, it can create that burst of light. And that could have happened if you just accidentally clicked it. So. Mm. Or even the search party could have picked it up and inadvertently clicked it.
Right.
So, ugh. Yeah. But the romance of imagining, oh, he got a picture of something in the sky and that was the last image he ever took. It just,
yeah.
we like to try to make connections there. And so,
yeah.
Yeah. No. Ah. Next. But it's interesting to me that Lev, at first, I was like, okay, Lev, but then he went into the, like, powerful balls of light uncontrolled by me, and I was like, okay, Lev.
No,
like,
no, no, you're not blinding me.
Yeah, you retired nope. and started drinking a little too much vodka.
Mm-hmm. Number 7. It was space aliens or a Yeti.
Sorry, we have to.
And, okay. Just a preface, Jen and I love cryptids,
mm-hmm.
Okay? But this, guys, we're not even going to waste time on aliens because it honestly feels like an insult to the hikers and their families.
Yeah.
If there is intelligent life out there, and I am confident it wouldn't be this sloppy or travel billions of light years to creep out the Siberian wilderness. I mean,
right. Like when you really think about it.
I mean, granted, everybody's always like, Americans always think that aliens are just for them. Like they're the only ones reporting it. So like, you know, here we Americans are like, Russia could never.
Okay, that's true. The aliens but, only want us, guys.
Take half of us, please. But yeah.
Yeah, if it's an alien counter, like specific abduction story. We'll talk about it all day, but that just feels like not the right thing to do in this case because it's just, that's not what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. And we are perfectly okay to discuss alien encounters when we are talking about, like Jen just said, an abduction story. And like she just said, this isn't the case. No. The Yeti gets brought up because the hikers made mention several times in their diaries about how they had been discussing the Mansi Yeti legend and a joke about how they looked like snow monsters themselves because they were so covered in snow. And that's pretty much the extent of it.
Yep.
The only reason this theory gets mentioned a lot is that there's a black and white photograph taken by one of the hikers of a human-like figure standing in the classic Sasquatch pose before the Sasquatch moment even happened.
I think, when is the super famous photo? When did that happen in the States? I need to look that up.
Google it. 1967.
Okay, so it was yet to come. That sounds right.
I don't know. Anyhow.
Yeah, it was yet to come. But it does look like that pose.
And it was captured through the trees. And since it's a little out of focus and you can't see a person's face, well, it does look creepy.
Yeah.
It also looks a lot like a person in a heavy jacket with the hood pulled up. And you can even see the separation between the jacket and the pants.
Yeah.
I don't think the Yeti wears clothes.
No. Not unless...
Or maybe he's like Pooh Bear in it.
Not unless he's really into fashion.
And the Discovery Channel did a horrendous special on this, literally just using that photograph. And the fact that one of their tongues was missing and said, it was a Yeti. Case closed. Again, they joked about it, so I can totally see one of them, like, standing off in the distance, mm-hmm. doing, like, the joke picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And being like, oh, you look like a snow monster.
Yeah.
But that's not what that was.
Look, I love a good Sasquatch story, but mm-hmm. again, not the case.
And they were documenting things so well, like journaling every day. If they had had a creepy encounter, I guarantee you they would have written about it.
Yeah.
So, next. All right. Theory number 8. The hikers' deaths were a result of a secret KGB mission gone terribly wrong. Now, this theory was developed by Russian researcher and author Alexei Rakitin, and it goes as follows. Alexei believed that three of the male hikers, Semyon Zolotaryov, Alexander Kolevatov, and Yuri Krivonoshenko, were secret KGB agents. Or were just hired by the KGB, and they would be going on a mission on this hike to uncover a cell of CIA agents under the guise of a backpacking trip. Their mission was to deliver faux radioactive samples, ding, 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 and then take photographs of the American spies to bring back to the KGB. But something went wrong, and the CIA agents killed the group. So they basically wanted it to be like, oh, they knew that there were American CIA agents already out there. They were going to accidentally, like, run into them somehow and pretend to be like, oh, like, funny, we should run into you, and then pass along these radiation clothes and then get pictures of them. Okay.
Uh-huh.
It sounds absurd now with us looking at it through 2025 lenses, but during this time, the level of fear and paranoia between Russia and the US was at an all-time high, and there were such things as spies. The KGB is very real, mm-hmm. very ruthless, the CIA. So, I mean, it's...
The table of contents for the theory is mm-hmm. like there. The execution is not.
Yeah. And the location is weird.
Exactly.
Yeah. And apparently Russia had been known to fool Western intelligence by planting radioactive tainted material from places that had nothing to do with it. So they're just going to try to throw them off the scent of what they were actually doing by being like, here's some stuff and give them a red herring, I guess. Now, obviously, the rest of the group would have been entirely unaware of the real purpose of their journey. And here are some undeniably weird details about the hikers themselves that is maybe why this theory continues to have some weight. One of the group members, who is 37-year-old bachelor Semyon Alexander Zolotaryov, who was a hiking instructor at a different tour base, joined the group at the last minute, and literally like the last minute, as in when they were all boarding the train with their packs, he was like at the train station, and Igor was like, oh, hey guys, like, actually, this guy, he's gonna come with us. And they were like, what? Okay, well, you're cool, so cool, come along. So, very last minute. Oh. And Alexander was actually a veteran with years of combat experience who fought for the NKVD, and he bore this weird tattoo, and I can't even, I'm so sorry, I'm going to try to say it, but it's Dyer Muaz Zoya. One word. Apparently, to this day, that word remains unable to be translated. So people are like, what did that mean? Secret society, weird, whatever.
Bro, that was a drunk bet night. That I'm looking at that word and my eyes are going crossed.
Tried to give himself a tattoo. Now, archives of the Ural Polytechnic Institute revealed a very fascinating detail about the hiker Alexander Kolevatov. Apparently, before he transferred to UPI, he actually worked in Moscow as a laboratory assistant in a top-secret scientific facility. It was an unnamed atomic institute that was only known as P.O. Box 3394. That sounds like the title of a fucking HBO Max spy show. So,
I mean, all I just see is my weird old P.O. box. PO244.
Mm-hmm. So he worked at a top secret facility, then transferred and became a UPI student, and then got involved in the hiking club. Then Yuri Krivoshenko worked in the even more notorious PO Box 404/10.
Error 404 not found. I love it.
And this was called the Plant Mayak in Chelyabinsk 40, where a massive nuclear disaster, second in severity only to Chernobyl, occurred in 1957. So with these little nuggets of intel, Alexei Rakitin was absolutely certain that none of these things were a coincidence, and that when the group of hikers surprisingly encountered the Americans, which he postulated they'd been secretly planning all along via the KGB, the Americans quickly realized this was not just all a group of happy-go-lucky college kids, and basically they just brutally massacred all of them. And up to a point, it sounds plausible, but without going through everything we've already been through before, you have to apply the same logic of reasoning of why a Mansi attack and a military attack or a prisoner attack doesn't make sense in this case. The way they were found, the lack of wounds, the lack of anything.
Again, it's not, the question isn't how they died. They died of hypothermia. Mm-hmm. It's why they died.
Yeah.
And again, this theory is out for me because of the lack of footprints.
Yeah, the lack of footprints and the massive amount of space between their bodies.
Also, I mean, you can stab them. You can break their necks. You mm-hmm. can suffocate them. There's so many ways to kill them all.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
And also, to these three people's credit who had pasts, just because somebody, they had worked for those places, that doesn't mean that A, they wanted to.
Right.
Or B, that they were automatically evil. Mm-hmm. They could have just had maybe a job they had to have to make money, and they were not on some sort of secret mission. So, you know, it sounds sensational, but maybe it wasn't anything at all. And they were just glad to be out of there and at UPI.
Right.
On a hiking trip with people their own age. Ugh. All right. Let's move away from the orbs and the CIA and get back into talking about natural phenomena. And this is where, to me, the theories gain more and more credibility. I'll see what you think, Caitlin.
I mean, I have my two theories that I'm saving to the end.
Okay.
Now we're on to theory number 9. The hikers were swept down the slope by a slab avalanche. In January 2021, a study was done by researchers at the Snow and Avalanche Simulation Laboratory at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne.
It sounded country.
Which, I found this on Reddit, but the people actually went to the animators at Frozen and used like their technology to simulate it.
Oh, that is cool.
So, little tidbit.
That's cool. I did not know that.
The study's lead and head of the institute, a man named Johan Guam, makes it clear that the group does not claim to have solved the mystery of the Dyatlov Pass, but rather, quote, show the plausibility of the avalanche hypothesis for the first time. Through a series of careful experiments and reconstructions that are all very sciencey, and we are not going to go super in-depth into them all here, or, I mean, we're still kind of pushing it, but this episode will be 4 hours long, filled with jargon that, but I'm sure you guys can find a full study and diagram for yourself.
Oh, yeah. So I quickly, instead of going through all that, I'm going to explain what I like to call the layer cake analogy. Mm-hmm. So basically what these diagrams illustrate is that when the hiker's tent was found, they had done something that was super common and very like up to protocol, which was you find a very, it was a very gradual slope where they cut straight down into the side of the slope, down through 4 or 5 layers of snowfall that had built up on top of each other to create this natural, like a L.
Like a 90 degree angle.
Yes, like a 90 degree angle, so that they could put the tent up against that 90 degree angle and it would basically be protected from wind. Mm-hmm. So the wind would be going down the slope, but it would not be hitting the tent because the tent was kind of nestled into that little 90 degree angle crook that they had dug. Now, the slab avalanche comes into play where just the right amount of weather conditions have to happen at just the right time, where one of those slabs that makes up the layers in the snow bank that would have been up against the tent, kind of creating that natural protection from the wind, actually became loose or was loosened when they dug down through the snow. And one of those slabs or layers just kind of becomes disconnected and like shoots out and goes down the side of the mountain. It is not a full-blown avalanche like we think of avalanche. It's like a one-off. A chunk breaks off, falls down, but these chunks could be very dangerous because depending how big it was, how fast it was going, that's not something you want to get hit by.
And be trapped under.
Yes. So basically, they are saying that a slab of dense snow, like the slice of a deadly layer cake, broke free and bad things ensued.
And if that would have happened, when the hikers heard the crack of it breaking and it subsequently started to slide, they fled from the tent in a hurry without their shoes and had cut that
the slash
in the back of the tent versus going out the front because there were buttons and like, I know there's like a theory as to why they didn't go through the front.
That it would have taken it, longer.
Yes, yeah. Like that is one theory.
That makes sense.
And maybe the entrance was already blocked and very soon got separated and disorientated. Everything we've already been over ensued. So it is scientifically possible.
Yes.
This is one that does have some ground to it.
Like scientific merit. And it does kind of account for the speed, which they would have left maybe. Maybe.
So are we diving into our theories now, Jen?
There's one more, and then we can fully dive. But
I think even if that were to happen, I think at least this theory needs to have more blocks to it to make it more.
Yeah. I just cannot get past that they left without any fucking shoes on.
Well, they left without shoes on. They could have easily just picked up their coats off the ground.
Yeah.
They
not even that. Yeah, they didn't have those on.
But I come back to the footprints that were seen leaving were not footprints in a hurry.
Oh, yes, that were like slow and deliberate. And it wasn't like they went tumbling down.
And then other things that I've read is even if it was a slab, avalanche regardless, you don't run down. Mm. You run parallel, like going through like a rip current.
Yes.
Because if you're going down, you're just following it.
Yes, and they surely would have known that.
And so, well, then also, this one doesn't fully check out to me because, yes, by the time the second wave of searchers like come and we know everything and there's snow on top of the tent. The tent's not covered in snow.
Correct.
It's not that much snow. And there's a flashlight on top left by the hikers.
That's right.
So to me, if a slab avalanche would have hit, they leapt, they came back. Because like, why would they have, like, oh, the slab avalanche is falling. Let me put my flashlight here. How would the flashlight have stayed there if it was still happening? And why would they come back to put the flashlight but not come back for?
Also, just from a logistic standpoint, where they were in the tent, in that little 90 degree area that they had cut out, would have been the safest place for them to have been. Because if a slab was coming down, you would think it would have just gone right over them. Like, they would have just hunkered down in the tent and like kind of protected each other instead of leaving it and running off.
I don't see how fleeing the tent without proper equipment was the better option.
Right.
For experienced hikers.
Yeah. Especially after they'd been out there in these conditions for 10 days already. So it wasn't like it was their first night. It wasn't like they didn't know what they were doing.
I do think the slab avalanche has more ground than, I know people discussed like a full avalanche. It's like, well, there's that. That's just not, it didn't happen. There's no proof of that.
Yeah. I think it's the most plausible of the ones we've come across so far, just in my running through all of them in my mind. But there's one more, and then we're going to open it up for discussion. And this last one, what are we now, number 11?
I think 10.
10. Okay. This last one is very interesting. And I think it might be the only one so far that truly accounts for why the hikers would have irrationally left the shelter of their tent without their proper winter coverings. And this is a theory that didn't come into existence until many years after the incident. So this is the theory that the hikers suffered from infrasound-induced panic due to a Karman vortex street. So, what the hell are those things? So, infrasound is created when sound waves travel through the air at a frequency below those that the human ear can pick up an audible sound from. But because it's a sound wave, it still causes those tiny hairs we all have lining our inner ear to vibrate and send impulses to our brain. And what this does is it creates this bizarre, like, disconnect in communication between the brain and the body, because the brain is like, everything's silent, but I'm receiving these weird signals. So what do I do? It basically causes an internal system freakout and manifests in symptoms that range from anxiety and nausea to downright panic-inducing terror and paranoia that can drive someone to feel the need to flee or even harm themselves or another person. And this is not just a theory. It is a well-documented, bizarre, but well-documented phenomenon that can occur naturally under the right circumstances or be man-made. It's actually long been a tactic of warfare and crowd control. Like, infrasound was pumped through speakers directly over crowds that were gathered to hear Hitler screaming about all the things he was screaming about, and he wanted them to feel paranoid and afraid and like ramped up, so they were using it for that. It's also extra creepy because it can be layered within a separate source of sound, so you can have infrasound still coming into your ear while you're listening to music if they're both happening at the same time, which is freaky. And this happened in 2005 when a Israeli military vehicle reportedly rolled through a protest of Israeli locals, and they were playing music from speakers, and within seconds, the people the vehicle passed by were reeling with disorientation and falling to their knees, vomiting and describing a feeling of extreme seasickness taking over them. So again, without getting too sciencey about it, these waves in the air are created when it has to be air of a certain speed encounter something obstructive in its path, and the wind bending around that structure and being split by that structure creates these infrasound frequencies. Like we said before, it can be layered within an audible sound, but it also occurs in the natural world when, for example, a large building with a very smooth, rounded dome gets hit with high winds. There are plenty of reports out there that you can find that, when I was researching this, so fucking fascinating. There are towns all over the world where entire, like, neighborhoods and like communities of people will be ravaged by infrasound sickness all at the same time. And they believe it is because of some architectural deficiencies in buildings that are causing it. And it's crazy. Or, buildings aside, it can be caused when wind is whipping around the smooth, barren summit of a snow-covered mountaintop, just like the one the nine hikers set up camp right below on the night of February 1st. Now, what is a Kármán vortex streak, and how do that and infrasound come together? So, in the right conditions, like a strong wind flow slamming into the perfect dome shape of Dead Mountain, this dome would have split the wind into a series of small but very powerful tornadoes, which would have ripped down either side of the pass. Not only would they have made a deafening noise that has been described as like a roaring train whistle, these other vortexes would have produced the silent but terrifying infrasound wave. So the combination of the train whistle, roaring wind, and the infrasound waves could have created, say, all the hikers gathered in the tent, they're putting together the camp stove, they're cozy for the night. All of a sudden, they would have been overtaken by this overwhelming urge of panic and terror. Maybe they felt nauseous. Maybe they, like, I gotta get out. They would have lost all ration and reasoning, which would explain why they left in a hurry, why they slashed open the back of the tent, because they weren't thinking clearly and maybe were like fumbling with the latches and getting frustrated. Mm-hmm. But once they were out in the cold and headed down the slope, the effects of that infrasound would have worn off pretty quickly. So unless it's happening continuously over a prolonged period of time, like say that tornadic wind had passed by, they would have felt super sick for a short amount of time, it would have passed, and it would have slowly worn off, and then the hypothermia and the direness of their situation would have taken over. So then you have everything else that came after that. That, to me, makes sense.
So are we getting into our theories?
Yes, is that let's your get theory? Into it. I don't know if it's what I fully land on, but I like it in that it was something that someone thought of that no one else did, but it actually accounts for their bizarre behavior. The, like, momentary psychosis of it all.
In the very little research I did, because, like, I just went off of what you gave me and whatnot, but the link to the theories that you just recently shared with me before this. So there's a YouTube video.
Okay.
By Bedtime Stories. And the illustrations are creepy, okay? Ooh. So don't watch them at bedtime.
Okay.
But they go over some of the theories. And they compare this story to a 1978 incident in Sweden with nine hikers.
What?
Seven boys, two girls.
Interesting.
Eight of them died. One survived.
Oh.
They had this.
No way.
Like, they were skiing all day or whatnot, And by the time it was time to set up camp, they mm-hmm. were exhausted. The wind was hitting them. And, mm-hmm. like, they dug a trench. Mm-hmm. There's eight. Five of them went into the trench to get, like, they had their tents and whatnot. Yeah. And they were getting blown away. Three of them, including the one who survived, was outside. And he was found. He survived.
Oh, wait. So they got blown away?
No. It was sound. Like, it was, like, the wind and the sound that was causing panic and whatnot.
Okay, so they had the same thing happen. Oh, okay. The infrasound
and
stuff?
And it was like around the same time. Mm-hmm. Again, 1978, so years mm-hmm. later.
Okay.
Obviously in Sweden, on a mountain. Mm-hmm. Same like time, same scenario, like with weather, whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, and it's just like the most logical. So what I believe logically is they were in their tent. They heard this noise. Mm-hmm. Panicked, left. Igor, someone put the flashlight on top so mm-hmm. that they could then see, like, I don't think they meant to go as far as they did.
Yeah.
I think in their panic, they mm-hmm. went for, because another thing that I have to continue reading, because mm-hmm. I, even just picturing it in my head now, I'm like, okay, they left their tent. Mm-hmm. They can still see their tent. It's nighttime, but they can still see. The moon apparently was only a quarter full and it didn't rise until 3 a.m. that night. It was pitch black.
Oh my god.
Ugh. And I'm just like,
that makes me feel icky just like thinking sick. About it. Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, so some of them were basically barefoot. They're stepping out in the snow. You're gonna get disoriented.
Yeah.
You're gonna have emotions, even if you're a Harden. Mm-hmm. And I think we go back to that. Mm-hmm. They're experienced. They mm-hmm. may be young, but they're experienced.
Yeah.
And I think you would think if it was the avalanche, mm-hmm. the slab avalanche, if you think it was an animal, mm-hmm. your best bet is to stay in the tent. Mm-hmm. You're together. You have shelter. Yeah. You have your warmth.
Yeah.
If you leave that, you're almost signing up for mm-hmm. death.
So it would have to be their rational functioning brains failing them in some way. Like that something happened where their brains just were not functioning properly.
I feel like it logically makes sense to me. And then account to the bodies, the two underneath the tree. Mm-hmm. They have the fire going. Mm-hmm. The three are headed back trying to find the tent.
Yeah.
Trying to, like, probably the other people can't make it. Mm-hmm. I could believe that the four that were found in the ravine, mm-hmm. I could believe that they fell. Mm-hmm. But I also like the theory that we had the two with the fire, and mm-hmm. then those four went down in the ravine, mm-hmm. made like a shelter out of the snow, mm-hmm. and the snow fell on them. Collapsing. Oh. It was enough snow mm-hmm. that it collapsed and crushed them, and that caused for the chest and the head injuries.
Interesting.
Because that was one thing I couldn't wrap my head around with the injuries is mm-hmm. that people, the reports were saying there was no exterior injuries mm-hmm. but internal. So it's like mm-hmm. how is your skull crushed but like not like if they had fallen, you would think that they would like their faces would be coned in.
Yeah, like, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
But at the same time, that's just what I'm logically thinking.
Yeah.
And then the illogical or like the conspiracy theory of me, there were bombs in the sky mm-hmm. that exploded in the air. They were like testing. The military was testing bombs mm-hmm. because in some reports it said the tops of trees were burned. Mm. And so, and yeah. those bombs could have caused the internal injuries.
Yeah.
And again, like the another form of psychosis, mm-hmm. they all die of hypothermia. Mm-hmm. We're not even going over the soft tissues, the eyes and tongues being gone. That's animals. Yeah. That's just mm-hmm. natural.
Yeah. Stuff. Yeah. We covered that at the beginning. Yeah.
So that's my theory. That's, I think when it comes to something like this, where it's just like the great unknown, when something is simply, when the most logical thing is put there, it mm-hmm. has to, like,
when you've eliminated everything else, the most plausible theory, it has to be one or the
and
other.
I mean, and it sucks in cases like this because we have the photograph of mm-hmm. the quote-unquote Yeti. We have the picture of the lights that we mm-hmm. don't know what that is. We have the journal entries. We have mm-hmm. the picture of Xena in Igor's book. We have cuts out of a tent. We have footprints that are walking slowly.
Yeah.
Like, we have the pieces, but we do not have the map to, like, put the puzzle pieces all together.
Even now with our eagle's eye view, I still feel like we're standing in a maze looking through it all.
But that's my theory, Jen.
I
want to know yours.
Oh.
If it goes off the path.
I really think that I agree about the infrasound mm-hmm. and the vortex street. To me, it's the one that makes the most sense with all of the pieces, and it doesn't leave like big chunks of pieces out. But mm-hmm. what I will say, and I know we didn't talk much about this in the theories, we talked about it at the beginning of the episode. I do find it odd that the investigation was so rushed to be yep. closed. I find it odd that the government wanted to bury them all in a single unmarked grave out in the wilderness, and that the families had to fight to have
yep.
their bodies sent back. And that could also be discredited because I'm looking at it with 2025 eyes, and you think about Soviet Russia and 1959, and they just wanted it over and done with. And maybe it wasn't actually nefarious, and it was just they didn't want the nuisance.
2020, 2021, mm-hmm. America was doing mass graves with COVID victims.
So,
but I agree with that though.
Mm-hmm.
If I went the military route,
yeah,
the military came in, shut things down.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think when the military paints a picture for you, you gotta listen.
Yeah.
You gotta view it.
Yeah. So what I do think is that there could have been something there, just because it came out that a couple of the hikers worked in former top secret places. So the government tried to shut it down because they didn't want people digging into yeah. those places. Let us know what you guys think.
I also think I want to mention, because I don't think we mentioned it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I think regardless of what happened, a lot of the stuff I read, I tend to agree with, and it could just be armchair detectives. Some were actual people who mm-hmm. have experience with hiking and like that type of hiking.
Yeah.
I do think that while their setup was like, it was textbook. It was what it was meant to be, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
They were a kilometer away from woods.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they not take the proper shelter in the woods that would have protected them from the wind, would have protected them more from the snow, whatnot? They had a wood-burning stove.
Mm-hmm.
They needed the wood for the stove. And a lot of the things I read is that Igor possibly didn't want to track downhill to have to track back uphill when leaving. But it's like, okay, well, if you're going downhill for the wood,
yeah,
why not protect yourself in that? So, and again, I'm not a fucking expert. I like a camper or a cabin. I'm not a tent person. So I'm just confused as to why that position was picked and preferred over the woods. Because as a, like, not expert, I Googled that question because mm-hmm. it was like, I would think being in the woods would be better than mm-hmm. being in the open wind with the wind,
yeah.
with the sounds.
Yeah. The only thing I would say to that is even if you are in the woods, uh-huh. you still have the wind coming
oh, yeah.
through. And the wind, I believe they would have not put the tent where they did if they knew that the angle
mm-hmm.
wouldn't be protecting them from the wind. So let's just yeah. say that, like, kind of that thing of when you go under a, like, the baseball dugout and you're hiding uh-huh. and the wind's coming from one direction, you're protected.
Right.
That was what that cut they made in the snow
did. I get
did.
That. I just, I...
They created, like, a solid wall between them and the wind, whereas yeah. in the woods, you're still kind of exposed to the elements more so.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't know. Maybe they were worried about branches falling on the, you know?
I guess,
don't know.
Like, to me, I would just think being in the woods, you have more coverage. You have a tree you can step behind to pee in. You have more, because they hooked their tent, their posts or whatever. They used their skis
mm-hmm.
as extra leverage for,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, well, you could have used a tree. And again, yeah. you need the wood for the wood-burning stove. You need, but again, I'm not the one traversing in the snow all day, and maybe that kilometer walk down was too much. Maybe they were losing light, and that was, we talk about, you wake up and you don't plan to be murdered, you know. They
right.
didn't pick that spot and be like, hey, you
yeah.
know what, we might die here. That's not
right.
their
yeah definitely not, because they were actually almost done,
yeah.
you know. That next day they were going to be going to the summit of the mountain, and then they were going to be making their trip back. So it's just, they were so close.
It's so annoying. I hate not knowing things.
And you guys can go down so many rabbit trails. You can spiral forever. You can actually read the case files that were released by the Russian government on this. I find them super fascinating, and they are out there and easily accessible. You just have to Google it, and we'll link it in the show notes. There's theories and YouTube videos, documentaries, terrible, terrible horror movies that have been done on this. But yeah.
And a warning, there are tons of pictures out there.
Oh my God.
I simply wanted to see the map of the tent and its correlation to the woods and the ravine and whatnot. And I happened to stumble upon pictures of the actual victims as they were found.
Oh God. Yeah.
And I don't recommend those pictures. I think it's a shame that they are. I understand why they're posted, like, in a sense, but I also think it's senseless to have those pictures of somebody's loved ones.
Yeah.
At their I don't know. But there's hundreds of the search team, their pictures. You can find the pictures of all the hikers themselves. Yuri. Pictures of
Igor and Zina and Rustique and all of them. Yeah, they were very evidently having the time of their life being out in the grueling wilderness.
They were.
Oh, but man.
Love to sit here with our theories and be like, yep, that's what's happened. But we're just two other armchair detectives that are sitting in a nice insulated house. We have no clue what they endured. We have no clue what Russia's like in 1959 in the winter.
Just, I know somewhere I am very glad I am not, because I wouldn't have lasted.
Jen and I would do it, but we'd be taking the opposite of the celibacy vow.
Yeah.
The celibacy. The drinking one. But this is one, guys, I really prompt you guys to leave your comments on Spotify, on our Instagram, TikTok posts. We really want to hear the theories on this one, what you guys might think.
Yeah, please let us know what you guys think. My brain is utterly fried, and I don't even know what case we're doing next, but we'll be coming back at you with something here next week.
Yeah.
Oh, man. All right, guys. Well, we'll catch you back next week for another episode of Camping is Canceled. In the meantime, remember to have courage and stay kind
of a bitch.
Bye.